Hello and welcome to the sixth episode of Mobile Podcast. Mobile Podcast gives you exclusive insights into the major public interest issues affecting the mobile telecommunications industry. I'm your host, Simon Clark, and in this edition, we speak with the former chairman of the Mobile Telecommunications and Health Research Program, Professor Laurie Challice. We'll ask Professor Challice about his views on the safety of mobile telephony, discuss his time with the MTHR program, and talk about risk communication in science. Professor Laurie Challice is an independent expert in the field of radio frequency radiation. He was vice chairman of the independent expert group on mobile phones that produced the Stewart Report in 2000, and recently he retired as chairman of the management committee of the MTHR program. He's also a member of the advisory group on non-ionising radiation and contributed to their 2001 report on emergency services radio systems and the 2003 report on health effects from radio frequency electromagnetic fields. Professor Challice has published more than 230 peer-reviewed research papers, and in 1996 he was awarded the Order of the British Empire for services to scientific research. Mobile Podcast is honoured to have Professor Challice as our guest. I spoke earlier with him by telephone from his office in London. Professor Challice, welcome to our program.
Thank you very much. Pleased to be with you.
Well, Professor Challice, let's begin with wireless networks and Wi-Fi. Last year you made some media comments regarding children using Wi-Fi-enabled laptops. Should children be using Wi-Fi-enabled devices, and do you believe Wi-Fi is safe?
Well, I'd say anything is safe because, of course, you never prove that. But I would like to say something about Wi-Fi because this is an issue, as you rightly say, of public interest and concern. And perhaps one should just remind myself that the technology of Wi-Fi is really quite similar to other phones, and so in thinking about Wi-Fi, it's quite useful to say, well, how does this compare with a phone, blah, blah, blah. And when I say it's similar to phones, remember, a phone, essentially one is communicating from one's phone to a base station by radio and hearing the information, getting the information back by radio. Well, much the same is happening with Wi-Fi. And there, the base station, if you like, is called a router, and it's normally stuck on the wall, probably quite high up, or maybe on one's desk, but not immediately next to one's head. And the computer has a device inside it, which is both a transmitter and receiver, so that acts very much like the phone. Now, both the router and the computer emit power very similar to that of a phone. So to the first approximation, since the frequencies are similar, we can say, well, okay, it's a bit like having a phone on your desk, maybe 30 centimeters away, or up on the wall, maybe 30 meters away, and a computer that in general is certainly not stuck right next to your head. Nobody sticks a computer right next to their head. So it's, again, 20, 30, perhaps more centimeters away. And since the emissions fall off as roughly as the square of the distance, if you've got something 30 centimeters away instead of 2 centimeters away from your head, that's a factor of 15, square that, and you're up to hundreds of times less exposure from any Wi-Fi component normally than you are from a phone. So since we are studying phones, and so far we have no evidence that it causes harm, but I must come to that later. We do feel that Wi-Fi, or I feel that Wi-Fi is very unlikely to be of anything like the possibility of concern that we might have from a phone. Now, I said they're normally not stuck next to our head, and of course that's true, but if you have a laptop, laptops can have the transmitter-receiver device either on the screen or in the base. Some of them have them in the base. So if you stick a laptop on your lap and you're online, that's to say you are transmitting and receiving, then you are being exposed in the area of the lap, which includes obviously reproductive organs, to similar sorts of exposure at least the maximums, are similar sorts to those you get from a phone. Now, in general, we're not too concerned about people using phones because they lie within the international guidelines, so you might say don't use them excessively. But we are concerned, at least in this country, about children's use of phones, because, as I said already, children could be, they are potentially much more vulnerable. We don't know. But they are vulnerable to so many other things. They might be vulnerable, more vulnerable to phones, and therefore they might be more vulnerable to Wi-Fi. So we felt it's, I feel anyway, certainly it's not a good idea for a child to sit their laptop straight on their lap, a centimeter or two away from vulnerable parts of the body, and then go on chatting, and then go on, I don't know, playing internet games or something for hours. So that was just the advice I was giving, that if you are using a Wi-Fi, child is using a Wi-Fi, stick it on a desk, stick it on a table, where it's a reasonable distance from your legs. Don't stick it on the lap.
This issue, I think, came most prominently to notice with that Wi-Fi program on the BBC's Panorama fairly recently. I think that program claimed that wireless networks in some schools had up to three times the exposure level of mobile phone masts. Is that a reasonable claim, and should parents be worried?
Well, even if it were a reasonable claim, and I really know no way of knowing, and you know, it's one of those strange statements, because the exposure you get from Wi-Fi from base stations and so on could vary hugely around the place, and obviously what you get from a router depends very much on where it is. But as I said already, the exposure is going to be very small. I mean, the exposure from base stations is usually hundreds or thousands of times less than the international guidelines. So somehow to express that as an alarming concern, in my view, is not a very responsible way of describing the program. So as I've said already, I don't think it's the Wi-Fi is a particular concern to most scientists, unless you're putting a laptop on your lap, and certainly in schools, that's a very unlikely scenario. Children would not usually use laptops on their lap, but use on a desk or a table, and certainly teachers should ensure that's what's happening. So I'm afraid that overall the Panorama program gave a very unbalanced picture of the present state of knowledge in this area, and I think was frankly alarmist. Not a good piece, not a good day for the BBC.
And that's an issue that crops up in this area all the time, isn't it? The accuracy of information that's communicated and the responsibility with which that reporting is approached in the media. Do you think there are initiatives that health authorities or scientists can take to improve communication on these sorts of issues?
Well, yes, I'm sure more needs to be done. I mean, it is a difficult area because, of course, newspapers, media want stories. They want interesting stories. They want some newspapers or whatever. And obviously, alarming story is much more newsworthy than a rather boring story, saying, oh, well, we don't quite know, but it seems very unlikely. So it's not easy to get a balanced picture in the media. But that doesn't mean to say we shouldn't, and I also should insist that some journalists, some newspapers and TV people and so on, radio people are highly responsible, and I have no qualms about their reporting at all. But a certain amount can be done by health authorities, and certainly after the Stewart report, which I already mentioned, the health authorities in the UK, the Department of Health, published leaflets, one concerned with phones and one concerned with base stations, and explaining essentially what how they worked and what exposure should be, and you know, what issues we knew about the health side, and what a bit of what more needs to be done. But like all these things, it's not obvious that they were very effective. I think it was a good idea, but what impact they had on people, I still wouldn't judge. We did do some research to look at this as part of the NTHR program, and it wasn't perhaps as encouraging as we might have hoped. Right? The other area you said is scientists. I mean, our health authorities need to do more. They need to learn how to do it better. But I think the scientists themselves also could do more, and many do. And I think actually this is one benefit, and a considerable benefit, has come out of the national research programs. Because all the research programs being done have created, if you like, a pool of scientists like myself who had no knowledge in this area at all before we started, or very little. Suddenly by talking to lots of people, reading lots of things, you become, if you like, reasonably expert, and your voice is totally independent. I have no extra grind, I'm not employed by industry or government, so I can say what I believe to be the situation. And of course that's true not only for people who are helping to manage the program, but all the scientists who are doing it. They become interested and so on. So suddenly we have created a reasonable number, a sizable number of people who can talk with an independent voice. And UK, there is an organization called the Science Media Centre, which holds a database of people, scientists like myself, who are willing to talk to the media when a story breaks. So the media can approach them, they can ring me up, say, will you be willing to answer questions on this? And so we have a dialogue going. The reporters, the newspapers know where they can get an independent voice if they wish to hear it, and most of them do. And of course, I say the UK, but in France, I'm on a similar committee to NTHR in France. I've just come back, in fact, from a meeting. And one of the things we talked about is an exhibition they're planning, a traveling exhibition they're planning, which will say more about this area and what we know about health aspects, and that'll go around the country. So people are doing this. We need to do more. We need to respond when we get the chance. And well, there we are. I mean, there's more needs to be done, and perhaps more research needs to be done to find out how we do it more effectively. But it's a big issue.
It is a big issue, and related to it, I think, is an issue prominent in this area, and that's the independence of science.
Yeah, sure.
What advice do you have for maintaining the credibility of scientific research? And I guess that takes us also on to the role that industry perhaps should play in this sort of science.
Sure. Well, industry clearly has an important role to play. But it has to play it very sensitively, because any organization that has or is seen to have a vested interest in something like this area, which clearly industry has, makes a lot of money out of this area, and governments make a lot of money out of licenses. So both these two major areas of our society are seen by the public to have vested interests. But equally, nobody else can fund the research. No, I suppose a charity could, but I mean, it is the major responsibility of the people who are making the product, making money from the product to fund it, and do so government. So we have to set up a system where the management of the research, the choice of projects, the way it's presented, everything else is done entirely independent of industry and government. All they have to do is sign the checks. Now, that's not the most satisfactory way, but I think both industry and government, certainly in this country, and I think in many others, has been very sensitive to this and have not tried to cross the firewall, as we call it. They've been very sensitive to the need. They're well aware that if it seems that what we're doing is somehow influenced by industry or government, then that piece of research can be rubbished by people who have an interest in rubbishing it. I'm not saying that industry will be corrupt in any way in doing research, but in public view, it might be, and that destroys the credibility of research. You're quite right. We've got to have a firewall. We've had an independent research and industry and government role is to fund it. Now, that sounds a very altruistic thing for industry to do. Why should they do this? Well, I think they have three sizable benefits emerging from this. One is clearly PR. I mean, clearly, an industry likes to be seen as responsible, and is clearly responsible to help to see whether this technology technology could be harming, in the long term, people's health. And put another way, suppose there was a group of companies funding research and one of them decided it wasn't going to. Well, you can imagine that in PR terms, how that would look should it come out, undoubtedly would. So I think industry is well aware that from PR point of view, it has no choice but to be responsible, and I'm sure it wishes to be responsible. Secondly, I've already mentioned funding these programs, which wouldn't exist without funding from industry and government, leads to this independent group of scientists who can speak with some authority. They're scientists who've studied a lot in this area, and they have no extra pride. And that's not just the media. I mean, I, just for example, have spoken in innumerable meetings of local authorities who call together a meeting because an industry wants to put up a mast. In protest, they say, well, the best way of doing this is to let the council hear what the story is, let the public come in. And obviously they brought in different sides, they brought in industry, they brought in probably one of the protesters. And they usually brought in somebody like me to try and give what we know scientifically about this area. So I think that's been a great benefit to industry as well, because we wouldn't exist if we weren't a program, and the program wouldn't exist if it had been funded by industry. And there is a third, now this is speculative, but it's my hunch. Suppose, and heaven forfend this doesn't happen, but suppose in the long term we find there is a link between mobile phone use and some nasty disease. Now, one can imagine that might lead to claims. And these could be quite substantial, as they have been obviously in the tobacco industry and so on. Now, I can imagine that if industry said, we're not going to fund research in this area, we're not going to try and find out as fast as possible whether this really does have an effect so we can do things about it. I can imagine that if industry took that position, then a jury might also take a somewhat negative view about the amount of claims that we've added. So I see this as a sort of insurance as well, that industry, by doing this, is taking a responsible view, and it's also, to some extent, giving itself a bit of protection should the worst happen.
And I guess one of the characteristics of scientific endeavour is that scientists can't always give certainty, can they? They can't always be dogmatic about, yes, there is this effect, or no, there's not. And is that, do you think, what is behind some governments and authorities wanting to give precautionary advice, and what's your opinion of the effectiveness of precautionary advice?
Yes, I think it is. I think, I mean, I said already that there is this hint, no more than a hint could be due to bias, about the long term. And there is also an issue which I didn't mention, I think, at that time, was that most cancers take more than 10 years before the symptoms can be detected, 10 years after whatever caused them. So since most of us hadn't used phones for more than 10 years, there's no way we can really be sure what their effect might be in the future. So this is where the government has to say, well, you know, there is uncertainty here. There's no way around this. There is uncertainty. And given there is uncertainty, what should you do? And obviously the advice that one can say is, well, don't use a phone more than you need. And for children, they might be more vulnerable. Try and avoid children, young children, using phones. And even when they're sort of teenagers, and parents' advice tends to be ignored in many cases, or very difficult because it's part of their social life. Try and encourage them to text, or again, still use it less. So this is precautionary advice. And obviously I have been asked to give similar advice, and you mentioned the one on laptops already. So, why does one give it? Well, I think it's a sort of responsible thing to do. You're asked, is there a problem? What should I do about it? You can't really do anything except to give some advice about what precautions you might take to try and minimize the potential of risk. How effective it is, that's a difficult question. I suspect varies very much from people to people, person to person. I mean, if you're very heavy phone user. It's very important to your life, both work and business, work and social life, then probably you will sort of bear this in mind and say, well, I'll live with it. I think parents are probably more inclined to accept this when it comes to children, because they recognize they've got a special responsibility towards their children to do what they can. So I think it's been effective, or more effective, in dealing with the issues of young children particularly. With adults, I'm not sure, but I can't see there's any way out. I think government or someone asks you advice, it's very difficult not to, and I think probably it's the only responsible thing is to do it. But how effective it is, well, I'm not sure.
And I guess, too, you spoke of the responsibility that people in your sorts of roles have for issuing some precautionary advice in these areas. Is it fair to say that there's a particular responsibility on the news media not to beat up or make alarmist statements about that sort of precautionary advice?
Oh, yes. No, I'm sure it is. I mean, you can extrapolate from the saying that the fact that there was precautionary advice, the fact that government industry is spending a lot of money doing research means there must be something there. And of course, that's totally wrong. You do the research because you want to find out if there's something there, and you want to be able to move to a position where you can say, well, I said already, you never say anything with faith, but you can move to a position where we can say the chance of this happening is becoming increasingly small, and people can make judgments on that just as they make judgments on all the other aspects of their lives. But media has an enormous role to play in this. Most people are not going to go and look up the website I mentioned to find out what the MTHR program said. You know, it's hard, it's not their main interest. They rely heavily on what the media tells them. So the media has a big responsibility. As I said, many journalists are very responsible. Others, I'm afraid, take a piece of research that's come out, it may later turn out to be complete rubbish. It may not have been even published properly, but it can make a nice story. And I think that's alarmist, and it frightens some people, and I don't think people should do it. There we are.
Professor Challis, we've covered a lot of ground, and I'm very grateful for your time. It's been a really interesting conversation, and I would like to thank you very much for joining us on Mobile Podcast.
You're very welcome. Thank you very much.
Mobile Podcast would like to thank Professor Challis for giving up his time to appear on the program. We'd also like to thank you for listening and hope you enjoyed the 6th episode produced in March 2008. Mobile Podcast will be available for download regularly at www.mmfai.org/mobile podcast or www.gsmworld.com/health. Mobile Podcast is made available for download by the Mobile Manufacturers Forum and the GSM Association. The information contained on this podcast is provided for general information purposes only and does not purport to offer legal, health or any other professional advice. Where reference is made to a company or a specific commercial product or service, howsoever referred, no endorsement or recommendation is implied or intended. The views expressed are those of the speakers alone and do not necessarily represent those of the Mobile Manufacturers Forum or GSM Association. All guests have volunteered their time to help promote an open discussion of the issues addressed.